Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats, silence your cell phones, for you are now listening to Much Ado About Wrestling!
Welcome, fair listeners, to Much Ado About Wrestling, the show that has until 5 to break the hold. I'm one half of your scholarly presenters, Andrew Terrence Caberline, and with me, as always, is the B-plus podcast host, Tyler Ward. Tyler, how are you doing? How do you feel about that grade?
I'll take it. I think it's acceptable. You know, I was a pretty good student in high school, but when I got to my higher education, I'll certainly take a B plus.
I mean, D's equal degrees.
this is true.
Which is a thing I feel like I said.
I have until fifth year to graduate. All right.
Oh, that's perfect. Welcome back, everybody. It's been a little bit of time since you heard from us. I'm going to chalk it up to me being just so exhausted from AEW Grand Slam that it took me this long to...
That's true. We still to talk about the live reaction.
Yeah. We can talk about that because, like, you know, spoiler alert, most of this episode is going to be talked about the career of one Bryan Danielson. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a deep dive. So maybe the Grand Slam stuff would actually... transition into that.
Sure.
Pretty well. I mean, there's been some other big things that have happened since we last recorded. Apologies if we don't get to them. Like, we could have done a whole episode about Finn Balor's rivalry with the top rope, and we could have done stuff about Hangman's return.
Hangman came back. I think the Saudi show, Crown Jewel, just happened.
Yes, it did. I was going to suggest maybe we talk about that for a few minutes.
Sure.
Because who knows when we would ever talk
about that again.
Yeah, it literally like just ended an hour or two ago. So I can't speak to the quality of the matches thus far because I've not seen it and I didn't really
plan on watching that.
No, I protest that show.
Yeah.
It's also weird that it's like a giant show that's out of canon. With
out
the rest of
canon,
WWE,
with all of these random legends coming back, all at the whims of one guy.
Yeah, but I figure I can run down. Do you know the results yet?
I know like one result.
Okay,
which is a positive one. It's a happy one.
I would say that like on paper, I'll read down the results to you, and we can get some live reactions to just the results and not the actual viewing of these results. On paper, it looks like it was it probably was one of the better Saudi shows, is what I would guess based on this. The show started with Edge defeating Seth Rollins in a 27-minute Hell in a Cell match.
Okay.
Which is an interesting way to start the Saudi pay-per-view with like the longest match of the night.
Uh-huh.
Then Mansoor defeated Mustafa Ali in a 10-minute match. Yeah, and he got help from a Saudi Olympian at the end who like came and helped. So that was definitely like to pop the home crowd kind of match.
Yeah.
RK-Bro retained their tag titles against AJ Styles and Omos in an 8-minute match. Sounds like it could have been on Raw.
Sounds about right.
In the Queen's Crown Tournament Finals, a 6-minute match, Zelina Vega is our Queen of the Ring.
Yeah?
She defeated Doudrop.
Hell yeah. Okay.
That's a pretty big swerve to me.
Big swerve. Yeah.
Yeah. Who would have guessed a year ago that Zelina Vega, the person rallying... I was going to say politicians, and I was going to have to put like quotes around it. Like, you got Andrew Yang to be like, let's
go
get
after
unions
WWE.
And wrestling is now back and being put in a prominent role as a wrestler.
I'm happy for her because I kept, since she re-signed with the company, and they've really just treated her like
not great. It's been I've been just thinking the whole time, like, man, I hope they give her something to make this worth it. Otherwise, God, she's got to be so upset.
I mean, she beat some pretty big people to win this, and I think she won it clean, as far as I can tell. But I mean, she beat Toni Storm in the first round, and then beat Carmella in the second round. So, like, she has beat people. It's funny looking at the other people who were in this tournament, that Toni Storm and Shayna Baszler and Natalya, who were like the three best technical wrestlers, were not in the finals. And that Liv Morgan and Carmella, who have been more like prominently featured on SmackDown than anyone else in this tournament, were not in the finals. And that Doudrop, who is like a face and has like had angles recently, didn't win. Zelina Vega got it. So maybe like the WWE saw this as the opportunity to give her something to inform her character. But I mean, she's been a present part of TV since she got back, even if it hasn't been like, you know,
she hasn't been like winning necessarily or doing great, but she's been on TV. She's been featured. And sometimes, I mean, that's the best you can ask for.
Yeah. So I'm excited to see what they do with her. I'm also excited to see what they do with the King of the Ring.
Yeah. New King. This is the one I saw.
Another shocker. Xavier Woods defeated Finn Balor. Using the top rope. Actually, I guess like reading how this match ended, I guess there could be a thing where Finn Balor becomes like I just can't get past this top rope, because he had a coup de grace reversed to lose. Xavier Woods is our King of the Ring king, our champion. How do you feel about that decision?
Oh, I'm for it. I am all for it. I love it. I love Xavier Woods. I think he's a great competitor. But I think Woods has always been kind of the odd man out when you think of the New Day as a whole. Kofi obviously was like the real standout star at the beginning. He was the first one to become a world champion. Big E was right after him. Again,
the blue chipper.
Someone you could see as a feasible world champion. Not to say that I don't see Woods as like potential world champion, but like within the WWE system,
go out on that limb. I don't think that's the best way to use him, too. I think he could be like, when things are all said and done, he could be maybe the best mid-carder in the history of the company.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, clearly the New Day as a collective, as we've been saying on the podcast, and now WWE is proving it, that they are, you know, the third biggest star in the company.
Yeah.
The three of them collectively after Roman and maybe Seth or Becky, and you know, it's like then it's New Day as a unit.
Yeah.
I really like that this accolade legitimizes Xavier as a wrestler to people who look at Kofi and Big E as world champions and then say like, oh, Xavier is lower. Well, now he has a singles accolade that he can hang his hat, or I guess hang his crown on, because I'm sure he will start wearing one.
It's going to be the most elaborate crown we've seen.
But it allows him to not, in storyline, have to ever, or at least for a while, like he doesn't need to have a world championship ambition. Yeah. You know, like this is enough to make them all conceivably equal.
Yeah, and that was going to be my point, that I think if not giving him a world championship, I will take King of the Ring. Like, it is a acceptable singles accolade that I'm glad he has.
And I like, even if this never gets referenced on TV, I like that Finn Balor is the runner-up, so he is the prince, in a sense.
You know WWE didn't plan that far ahead, but it's a cool coincidence.
Moving on, Goldberg defeated Bobby Lashley in a no holds barred false count anywhere match that was 11 minutes long. I think he speared Bobby Lashley through a few tables to win. That's I mean, they must have a third match
I guess so. I mean, they're going to need a rubber match, but was Sundberg present? Was he there?
I can't tell. Sorry that I'm like, this is the least professional that we've been, just being like, no, we didn't watch fine. It. We're going to talk about it. But like, as far as I can tell, the Hurt Business were involved in the match, but I don't know that Sundberg was. Okay.
Well, I mean, shoot, if anything, I'm glad the Hurt Business is now a thing again.
Yeah, me too. But I imagine this will be that the third and final match will either be a Survivor Series or Royal Rumble, because they, I mean, something else we could have talked about in our interim is they canceled TLC.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, their December pay-per-view is no more. And they're going to do a January 1st super show instead.
It's almost like, is that good for, I guess it's good for the competitors. Like, maybe they get a weekend in January or December off.
Yeah. Well, this is a win for the wrestlers and maybe a morale booster too. That like right before you go into the beginning of WrestleMania season to actually give people a little break around holiday time.
Yeah.
Man, this is the smartest, talent relations move they've done in some time. They were due. Big E retained the WWE Championship against Drew McIntyre with a clean victory, which is really big for Big E and something he needed.
Good.
Becky Lynch retained the WWE SmackDown Women's Championship in a triple threat against Bianca Belair and Sasha Banks that went 20 minutes. I will check that one out. I can't really tell how good or bad it was, but that, I mean, them getting 20 minutes sounds real
good.
Great to me.
Yeah.
And then in our main event, Roman Reigns defeated Brock Lesnar to win to retain the Universal Championship in 12 minutes. It was not clean at all.
That's the answer.
I'm going to read it to you verbatim here so that we have the context. So Lesnar hits, they start spamming finishers on each other. Lesnar hits a F5 on Reigns, but knocks the referee down. Reigns hits a spear on Lesnar. Heyman throws the title in the middle of the ring, and Reigns and Lesnar have a tug of war with the title. The Usos come
again?
Out.
Again?
Yeah.
The we Usos. Returned to the tug of war.
But that was, I mean, that was in a go-home show, right?
That's
before Mania, it wasn't actually within a match.
Yeah.
So it's a callback.
The
Usos come out and attack Lesnar so that Reigns gets the title, hits Lesnar in the head with the title, and then they wake up the referee and pin him. I think, storytelling-wise, what happened here, and we'll have to, look at the tape to confirm, is that Heyman threw the title in the middle of the ring, and it's not clear if his intention was to give it to Reigns or give it to Lesnar.
I like
that. Yeah, it's the beginning of a thing that you and I both clamored for, which is having a Paul Heyman on a pole type match for WrestleMania. So I think this feels like the beginning of Roman's
ladder WrestleMania, match for custody of Paul Heyman.
Yeah. Oh my God. If only. That is Crown Jewel. I was gonna say no notable snafus, it seems, no Titus O'Neil falling under the ropes. This ended two hours ago, so like maybe I should hold my tongue until the wrestlers are back in the United States.
Because things could go wrong then. That was because I saw that the show had just recently ended because WrestleTalk had already posted like a review video, and their title was literally "Nothing Bad Happened."
That's great. Yeah. So it does sound like maybe the Hell in a Cell and the Triple Threat are worth checking out.
Yeah.
So
You must watch this show, check those out.
I went to a show that I had to watch.
Yes, you did.
It was AEW Grand Slam. I know it's like 3 weeks old at this point now, but I feel like we need to.
We should talk about it.
Do you have any like questions or topics you have for me as the like in the arena reporter?
Actually. So first question: what merch did you get?
I did not get any. Here's the reason why. Here's my one. I'll start
Sold
my
out.
One negative for the show, as a from a viewing experience, is that Arthur Ashe Stadium is really cool and is unlike any other venue that I've ever seen live mm-hmm. events in before. It's built in a way that is kind of straight up from the inside. So mm-hmm. if you think about a normal basketball slash hockey stadium, if you think about how big the floor is because it has to be able to hold the ice rink.
Yeah.
And then you think about the basketball court being a little smaller than that. And then you think about Arthur Ashe being built specifically and only for tennis and how much smaller a tennis court is than a basketball court. Then you can picture taking these big 18 to 22,000 person arenas and not getting rid of any of the seats, but just pushing everything in. There's like no floor there, right, basically. Okay. So what that meant is when we were all going crazy doing yes chants on the second or third yes, I could hear my first one already hitting the back wall and coming back into my ear. It was the loudest place that I've ever been in my life. But the negative is that because it is not used to being at full capacity except for at the finals of the US Open, the concourses are really narrow, and like getting food or merchandise was a real hassle. Friend of the show, Pat Stango, and I at one point were like, we have to get up and eat something. So we missed all of MJF, Brian Pillman, and the first 5 minutes, I would say, of Malachi Black, Cody Rhodes, because we were like, we have to go get some chicken fingers. Like, and in the line, there were, I think, maybe like six or seven different occasions of people coming up to me because once we were getting closer in the line and asking if they could Venmo me to buy them stuff too, so that they could go back in. So like I didn't even get close to the merchandise. I walked past it once, but it's like I needed the food to keep going. Like
That's
I didn't need the merchandise, and then I bought a bunch of it later when I got home. So
there you go. All right, second question.
Yeah. Yes,
what was the best match? I mean, I think I know the answer, but like, I want your
the 1A answer is Kenny Omega and Bryan Danielson.
Okay,
for the time limit draw, this was my first. I think we talked about this before. This was my first live TV taping ever that I've been to, so it felt notable to me for that reason. It felt like a moment. I mean, when they put up the graphic right when the show started, that was like, this is the match that we're leading off with.
Right, right.
It came unglued then. And I think that it was a fantastic decision from the booking standpoint. Because then it was like so loud at the beginning of this show. Pat Stango was in line for a hot dog at that point and sprinted back to, like, I think like all of the concession stands suddenly were empty.
That's totally fair.
Yeah, I mean, that was beyond the actual like work of the match and getting able to see a Broadway, relatively close to Broadway. I think like even if the match was a dud, just the excitement in the first 5 minutes was
worth it.
Yeah, it was like I haven't felt anything like that. The closest thing I felt like that to a live wrestling show is the last like 7 minutes of when we saw Bayley and Sasha in Brooklyn, where like people were like realized what they were watching was important historically.
Because my other thing I was gonna say, like when we saw Andrade and Gargano at TakeOver, like that was awesome in the moment, and like watching it I was like, wow, that was a really good match. But that was one of those matches that I don't think we really appreciated until the after, and everyone was like, this was an incredible match. And I guess the other thing would probably be Shinsuke winning the Rumble, because that was really freaking hype.
That was, We've seen some great stuff.
We've seen some pretty cool stuff.
Honestly, like, the match that I probably will go back and watch before I watch the time limit draw was Super Click versus Christian Cage in Jurassic Express.
Yeah.
That was like actually maybe a better, more fun, crazy match.
Yes.
And it's the only match where, and it was a long show because they taped a lot of stuff. That was the only match where the security guards around the bowl turned around and watched that match, and were like people with like I would guess limited wrestling experience and exposure
were looking
at like moves that were being set up by the Young Bucks and Luchasaurus and stuff like that as they're being set up, and be like, what is he doing? And then they would do it and they'd be like, they were going crazy. So that was, I was watching the security guards watching that match for the most
part, honestly.
But that was, that was fantastic.
Okay. Last and final question.
Yeah.
Was the filming of Dynamite and Rampage back to back, was that too long for a live experience? I ask this mostly because I will be going to a similar taping in November. Or actually, we both might be. But
yeah, that's true. I think it was like just as long as it needed to be. There were people who definitely left after Lucha Brothers, Santana Ortiz. And I don't think that I can fault those people, because also with the difficulties of this particular show, this particular venue, is it the stadium exists in a space that otherwise has nothing else. So they're very, and it's at like the very last stop or very second to last stop on a ride.
Gotta catch that train, get home.
I think I got home probably at 3 a.m.
Oh my God.
It took, Chelsea just said two. She corrected me. My hyperbole. Whoa. But still, the show ended before midnight, and then I got home at two.
God.
Yeah. So I felt very bad for the one really drunk woman who came onto our train and was like, why are there so many people? And why are they all wearing black t-shirts? but then she sat down next to me and told me I wasn't allowed to talk. She was very aggressive. You can ask Pat about this next time you see him. It was almost the best match of the night.
It's kind of nice almost. She's like, don't talk. You're like, I wasn't planning on it.
I was like, I'll shut up. I will gladly shut up. It didn't need to be any longer than it was, but I felt like it was a perfectly apt. I would do it again if that's the question.
Well, you might just be.
Yeah. All right. Well, now that we've gone 20 minutes on catching ourselves up,
perfect.
It's time to get into Bryan Danielson or Daniel Bryan, depending on which way.
If you're CM Punk calling one of his matches on live TV and call him Daniel Bryan.
I don't fault him for that.
I don't fault him at all. I just thought it was funny.
It is interesting. Because this is certainly not the first person to name change to, be on one TV televised promotion and another one. But I think I am having a hard time referring to him as Bryan Danielson. And it's funny because he was Bryan Danielson for so long. But I think it's because his two names are actually so similar.
They're just phonically. It's just they're so similar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we should start calling him by what Chelsea has referred to him as, which is Daniel Bryanson. And I think that that is the happy medium.
I could do that.
Yeah.
Daniel Bryan. All right. So I'm thinking, how we can just run through it much like we have in previous ones. But, we can't start running through it until we begin with another prolific statement.
Yeah. I've been thinking about this all day, honestly.
This is 100%. Whenever we do these deep dives into people, I'm 100% just adding in the prolific statement.
Yeah. It's a struggle to try to be prolific without being too saccharine or without being too hyperbolic, right? So I'm gonna try to thread the needle on this, but this is a particularly difficult one for that. So a prolific statement about Bryan Danielson and this is a statement that I think, only a few short years ago, this statement wouldn't be true. is that Bryan Danielson is important to the context of pro wrestling because he is the only person who has been who has held the moniker of best technical wrestler to have actually reached his potential.
Yeah.
Dramatic pause to let that sink into people.
I agree though. No, yeah, because when you think about, you know, the even traditional wrestlers who have been labeled as like the greatest technical wrestlers ever, your Chris Benoit's or even your Ricky Steamboat's, your Ric Flair's. Well,
man, your Dynamite Kid's.
Your Dynamite Kid. Ric Flair has never really labeled that.
Yeah, and like Ric Flair, I guess, is also. Yeah, he never had that. He had other monikers too, but like.
But he was certainly never. No one ever considered Ric Flair the greatest technical wrestler. Yeah.
But it's interesting that label. And there's like, I mean, Wrestling Observer Newsletter has an award named after Bryan Danielson now that is the best technical wrestler in the world award every year. But it is interesting looking at the people who have held that crown and seeing how much tragedy is related to them. You mentioned Chris Benoit, and we all know why that's tragedy.
And you mentioned Dynamite Kid.
Dynamite Kid for similar but different reasons. I mean, I think you could, I don't know if people ever called Eddie the best technical wrestler in the world, but he certainly, if he wasn't the best, he was close to it and, you know, is also suffered a tragic end. Dean Malenko is not a tragedy, but that is someone who certainly held that moniker for a lot of the 90s and due to injuries, never really reached the heights that I think a lot of people thought he would reach. And then you look at people like Kurt Angle. I guess Kurt Angle did reach his apex, but certainly had his career shortened due to drug abuse.
And you could, I mean, honestly, I would, don't get me wrong, I love
Kurt Angle.
It's
one of big one,
I love Kurt Angle, but I would argue that even Kurt Angle at the top of his game, at the height of his appeal, doesn't quite measure up to like Daniel Bryan, like to what he had been.
I would agree with that. And then you have, I mean, another person whose career was stunted by drug abuse is the person that Daniel Bryan has modeled himself as a wrestler off of, and that's William Regal. I mean, it's been well documented that at every point that he was about to get a bigger role is when he would have drug issues. The last one I was going to throw in there was Shibata too, another person who was forced to retire early.
But you've been following the news cycle, I think Shibata is back.
Wait, is that true?
I think it was just like G1 news from like yesterday or today. I think Shibata is back. We're going on a little bit of a tangent but this is absolutely something you should look into. I think Shibata is back.
So that's going to be the Wrestle Kingdom match this year. Will be Bryan Danielson versus Shibata.
Jesus.
Oh, man. In a loser dies match.
dies match.
Well, we'll get to that when we get to it then.
Yes, yes.
But, I mean, and up until a few years ago, Daniel Bryan was just another part of that lineage of tragedy when it came to the best technically gifted wrestlers. He had to retire for terrifying health reasons far earlier than anyone would have guessed. And now, due to the grace of advances in medical science and maybe more relaxed insurance policies, he is back. And has regained that mantle of best technical wrestler, or at least the most prominent technical wrestler in the world, with gusto ever since. And it does Daniel Bryan now, and Bryan Danielson even more now, has this feeling when you watch him of of a appreciation that any time you watch him could be the last time you watch him. Mm-hmm. And I think that while that could like scare certain audience members or it could like stunt a performer, Dan O'Brien's looking at it the opposite way of any day could be my last time performing, so I'm going to make sure it's the best match possible. Mm-hmm. Was that prolific enough a statement without being hyperbolic or too sweet? It was more of a downer.
I will take it.
Yeah. So let's look at the career then of,
all right,
of the American Dragon.
Absolutely.
There's really no one else in his time period who is like him, which is interesting to me, yes, as well. And I think we're going to see some mm-hmm. ways that he bucked trends throughout this.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're going to kick it off. Brian Lloyd Danielson was born in Aberdeen, Washington, May 22nd, 1981. I had to add this just because I thought it was so wonderful and it describes him so well. He is the son of a literal lumberjack.
I never knew that until now.
Yes, his dad was a literal lumberjack.
How was that not brought up all the time in WWE? Like, that's a missed opportunity.
I'm almost glad that they didn't, because real quickly he could have turned into like a cartoonish character, like specifically when he was the new Daniel Bryan, mm-hmm. the eco warrior,
eco terrorist, like, yeah.
Jesus. But like, I think that would have been a really cool even just layer to add when he was that character, to be like, my own father took care of this planet or something, you know, like,
I mean, he cut down trees. So, well, I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm sure that lumberjacks are actually pretty environmentally sound,
sure,
would be my guess. And I guess there could have been a world where then like Bryan Danielson could have become the, you know, master of the lumberjack match, the way that like Jeff Hardy is the master of the ladder match. And maybe, yeah, we didn't need that. So maybe it's good. Fair. Continue.
Bryan Danielson. So he first began training as a professional wrestler after graduating high school in 1999. He attended the Texas Wrestling Academy, the TWA, under the tutelage of Rudy Gonzalez and one HBK, Shawn Michaels.
So yeah, if I remember correctly, that was like Shawn Michaels' school, but Rudy Gonzalez was definitely the one who was actually like training everybody, right?
Yeah, I think so. Because I was going to say, that's like a sort of known fact about Bryan Danielson, that they say he was trained by Shawn Michaels, but like how much he actually had a hand into it is debatable.
Mm-hmm.
So he began training there after his wrestling debut in December 1999. He toured Japan with Frontier Martial Arts Wrestling, FMW.
Yeah, we've talked about them on the show before.
We have talked about them. There's also a great Dark Side of the Ring episode from Vice that I think just came out about FMW.
Oh, wonderful.
And he would wrestle there alongside Lance Cade, you remember Lance Cade, R.I.P.
I didn't know that maybe I did know that he was at TWA at some point, but I didn't know that he was actually like in Japan with,
yep, mm-hmm, with,
I should look up that match.
In TWA he went on to win the tag team championship with one Spanky Brian Kendrick.
Yeah, Spanky. It's interesting also, I guess, when if I said that there's no one quite like Bryan Danielson from his generation, I feel like there's also kind of no one else quite like Brian Kendrick. And knowing mm-hmm. that they came from the same place and they are very, yeah, close, it's interesting to look at the diverging paths that they,
yeah,
took.
Yeah. Well, it's like when doing this research, I thought it was amazing to me to realize how far back they went, because I knew that they had history before. And even in the Cruiserweight Classic, when Brian Kendrick was competing and Bryan Danielson was on commentary, he talked a lot about how he's like, you know, Brian and I go way back. He's my pick to win this. I hope he pulls it through. I didn't realize that they were literally tag team champions in like the first promotion that Bryan Danielson ever, yeah, wrestled in.
They're
like,
pre Ring of Honor.
Pre everything, yeah.
I'm pretty sure there does exist, maybe even on the network. I know the network doesn't exist, but maybe like mm-hmm. it may be on Peacock, that there is a house show, dark show match between them around this time on mm-hmm. WWE television, where Bryan Danielson is wearing the American Dragon mask and they wrestled for like 8 minutes because HPK was in town and is like, you got to see my trainees. But I'm pretty sure that it does exist somewhere that you can watch.
But so going on, he at this point, we're going to move into the American Dragon, the beginning of this moniker for him.
We're going to Bryan Danielson, enter the dragon.
Enter the American Dragon.
All right, keep going. Don't let me do those cheap jokes.
He signed a developmental contract with WWF in 2000 with Memphis Championship Wrestling, which was one of their numerous developmental territories at the time, where he was trained, like we had said, by William Regal at this time. During this time when he was training there in Memphis Championship Wrestling, that he began for the first time using the moniker the American Dragon. So I didn't know the American Dragon was a pre Ring of Honor thing. I thought like it came to life there, but apparently it was.
Yeah, it is. as I remember it being told in some interview with Brian, was that around MCW it was a little bit of a joke, and that he was like a Japanese type wrestler in this developmental territory. And then I think like as he continued to do more tours in Japan, as I know you're going to talk about, that's where I think they were like, oh, maybe that should be the gimmick that you run with.
Yeah. He went on to win the MCW Light Heavyweight Championship, as well as the tag titles, again with Spanky Brian Kendrick, before being released from his contract in July 2001. After this, he went to Japan, competing in NJPW, again using the American Dragon moniker, and even donning a red, white, and blue dragon-esque mask.
They love their masks for their juniors there.
Yes, the American Dragon mask. That would be a crazy callback if like we see him on Dynamite 1 week or something with something like that.
He's got to
like have one or two of those masks still.
Yeah, I mean, if he ever was in a 6-man tag like with the Lucha Bros or with some other people that already wear masks, so I feel like that would be a great opportunity to whip it out, you know.
That would be so cool. While wrestling in NJPW, he did win the IWGP Junior Heavyweight Tag Titles with Curry Man Christopher Daniels.
That is my favorite mask in wrestling history, because it does
the Curry
have
Man
a,
mask?
It has a bowl of curry on top
it
of
does,
the head,
yeah,
and
yeah.
It is outstanding.
what was amazing for me is because this was in like 2001, I didn't realize, because I knew like Christopher Daniels had wrestled as Curry Man before, but I thought that was like a later thing. I didn't realize that he was doing Curry Man way back in 2001.
But I think he was only doing it in Japan.
Okay.
Where like now, like he has definitely been Curry Man stateside,
right?
A handful of times.
We've seen Curry Man in like TNA.
yes, we have. We certainly have.
Yeah. From 2002 to 2003. Danielson would make several appearances for WWE as enhancement talent on their secondary shows. Heat and Velocity, he would lose pretty much every match to some big names at the time. Sean O'Hare, Little Guido, Rico, and even a young John Cena.
You mean you're telling me there exists on Velocity a match between the American Dragon, Bryan Danielson, and Rico Constantino?
That's exactly what I'm telling you.
Yeah, I think I probably saw that at that point. I think that Velocity match against John Cena is also pretty widely available. And I know that the first match that they had together in WWE when, you know, like a decade later, that they, I think, did the exact same opening few minutes.
Same like opening minutes or two?
I think that it was like there's definitely a side by side video out there somewhere of this. Yeah.
I mean, that's reading that, I was like, wow, you're telling me John Cena and Bryan Danielson had a match on Velocity? I would love to see that. And again, like I probably did watch that as a kid.
I kind of very distinctly have in my mind Bryan Danielson wearing like all white trunks during that, and this is like some of the first jorts from John Cena, I think, too. So
yeah,
that to give you a time period.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this is from 2002, 2003 is when Danielson would be making these random appearances for WWE as their enhancement sort of thing. But however, in 2002, Bryan joined Ring of Honor officially and is acknowledged as one of the founding fathers of the promotion. On February 23rd, 2002, in fact, he competed in the main event of the company's debut event, The Era of Honor Begins, in a three-way match against Christopher Daniels and Loki.
I had this pay-per-view. That's
yeah,
using the terms pay-per-view very loosely. I had this on DVD. And I watched this particular main event many times. I'm pretty sure that you could still get Ring of Honor early day DVDs. I think they're still pretty accessible, and I highly recommend it as a time machine for wrestling fans to look at, especially now, because the first year of that company, everyone who shows up, well, not everyone, there's
most
like
people.
the Spanish announced team and the SAT and some of the other people don't end up doing a whole lot, but most of the people end up becoming gigantic stars. And I mean, I can very distinctly remember the audio and how fuzzy it was. And I can remember the one stationary camera and then the one guy roaming the outside of the ring with a handheld camera, and that being the two. And it's some of the great, like, most enjoyable stuff, honestly, that I remember to this day. I very distinctly remember going to the Suncoast DVDs in the mall, where they would have a lot of Japanese wrestling, and then every once in a while they would have a Ring of Honor DVD come there, and I would buy it no matter what it was. So did you have a lot of access to Ring of Honor? I mean, I was getting this like a few years later, because once Joe and Punk and AJ Styles and TNA became a thing, like, I think that is when I really became aware of Ring of Honor.
Yeah, that was for me. Yeah, when this was happening in 2002, I was not aware of indie wrestling in general. I was just too young. I was in my WWE bubble and didn't really care to look elsewhere. So I think, I mean, the only access I might have had to it would have been, like an FYE or some video store you would find in a mall that would just happen to have DVDs or something like that. And I'm sure I've walked past aisles of these DVDs before and been like, that doesn't look like WWE wrestling. But
it sure didn't. Really, very... interesting art on those early DVDs.
But so this was the beginning of Bryan Danielson's tenure in Ring of Honor. Some of his notable matches that he had, I had to pull this one because this sounds bonkers. He had a match with Austin Aries, performed on August 7, 2004, at Testing the Limit, that lasted 74 minutes before Aries was finally declared the victor.
And when you say declared the victor, I think, was it like they went to like a referee's discretion to like pick the winner kind of thing? I think that might be what happened, where like
it
they
might
collapsed
have been
from
what
exhaustion
happened. 74
and they needed a
minutes
winner.
Is crazy. That is insane.
Yeah.
That's longer. That's like, I think that's longer than the longest Royal Rumble, even almost. Or no, probably not longer.
I don't
but
know
real
that
close.
One where they had like 40 people instead.
Oh,
I think
well,
was pretty
yes,
long,
of course.
But
that one.
It's a long time.
Or the greatest Royal Rumble that Braun Strowman won in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, well, that's not part of the canon. But like, no, yeah, Ring true. Of Honor, even as early as 2004, was doing these marathon matches. Because you have to think, like, contextually, ECW has closed up shop, and like most of the people in the early Ring of Honor shows were people that Paul Heyman was about to bring in to ECW. And then it's like people from ECW that didn't get signed by WWE. So you got like Tony Mamaluke and the FBI and like CW Anderson shows up. Like a lot of like the lower card people end up in Ring of Honor. And it was like, you can hear Paul Heyman talk about in interviews where like had ECW lived on, that he was getting ready to phase out the hardcore aspect of it and be like, we are going to be the MMA inspired, totally true sport, professional wrestling promotion, which is what Ring of Honor
prided itself being on.
Yeah, everyone had to shake hands at the beginning of matches, the code of honor, and then their DQ matches still went by the greatest name for a gimmick match ever, the Fight Without Honor, which I think we're going to talk about at some point here. But like, I was totally for that aesthetic, and it worked. It worked very well for. Yeah, people are honking and agreeing with me. I mean, Brian Danielson.
They love that match.
Those founding fathers, like Christopher Daniels was a indie legend at that point already. And then Loki was a, you know, like a living kung fu movie character. Mm-hmm. And then Brian Danielson was the American Dragon. So these are the three people that really most represented the way that Ring of Honor wanted to present themselves at the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Another notable point, Brian Danielson won the company's inaugural Survival of the Fittest tournament in 2004. He also, so going off that 74-minute match he had with Austin Aries, he had feuded with Austin Aries quite frequently for the Ring of Honor world title, Austin Aries being champion at the time. But he was never able to capture the belt from Austin Aries. He did, however, finally become the Ring of Honor World Champion in September of 2005 when he defeated James Gibson, or Jamie Noble, as he might be better known as, at Glory by Honor 4. I didn't know Jamie Noble was in Ring of Honor. Interesting.
I'm pretty sure he won the title off of Punk Punk left. I could be wrong about my Ring of Honor title lineage. He definitely took it off of someone who had had a long reign, or someone who seemed untouchable. Maybe he took it off of Joe, but am I crazy about that?
I don't know about that.
Yeah, I'll look it up.
We'll get into more of that. At the beginning of 2006, Ring of Honor began a kayfabe interpromotional feud with Combat Zone Wrestling, CZW. We've talked about CZW on here before. With Danielson and Chris Hero at the head representing their respective promotions. Chris Hero being from CZW, Danielson representing Ring of Honor. So this beginning, this interpromotional feud they had that actually went on for quite a while. So immediately right at the beginning of this interpromotional feud, Danielson and Chris Hero had a match at Ring of Honor's Hell Freezes Over event, in which case Danielson did win. And this was in the beginning of 2006. By the summer of 2006, in fact, July 15th at Death Before Dishonor 4, this feud was still going on. And they were having like a very traditional sort of Survivor Series-esque style match where a team from Ring of Honor is going to face a team from CZW. Brian Danielson would go on to fill a vacant slot on Ring of Honor's five-man team, which participated in this match, and it was a CZW specialty. It was a steel cage match called the Cage of Death, a 10-man tag team match, very similar to War Games in that two competitors start, and then a timer would allow new competitors to come in gradually and so forth. During this actual match, Danielson actually turned on his team, the Ring of Honor team, by assaulting his rival, Samoa Joe, before leaving the match and effectively abandoning his involvement in the animosity between the two promotions. He was basically saying, like, I'm done fighting for Ring of Honor against CCW. He just attacked Samoa Joe and got out of there. Didn't really... So already the Ring of Honor guys, not very happy with Brian Danielson. And I think also... probably the fans not much as well. I'm not sure if Brian Danielson was already a heel at this point, but like that definitely cemented it.
It's amazing that this happens like a few years after the invasion angle, because Brian Danielson was Ring of Honor's Steve Austin in a sense at this point, that he was like definitely the biggest kayfabe, like the best wrestler in the company and the most representative of the company, but was also like a heel. So he had to be on this team, but also be a heel. I just want to like run down the whole CCW versus Ring of Honor thing for just a second. Cause I don't know if we'll ever talk about it again, but this was like for burgeoning super fans like us, this was what really made me love the internet with wrestling at the time too, that like, this very real seeming war between the two biggest independent promotions. We talked about Ring of Honor being branching out of ECW and being like, this is what ECW is going to be. CZW is like the branch the other way. And they were like, we're going to continue on the hardcore legacy and push it forward. And to have them do this year-long crossover feud was the smartest thing I've ever seen done on independence, because their fan bases hated each other and the wrestlers loved each other. So like, it was, you really, like, it got, it made fans more, take more ownership of what they were fans of in a time when there was no clear number two in wrestling. I think this is really something that put both companies on the map. I mean, that match, that 5-on-5 match, Team Ring of Honor is Ace Steel, Adam Pearce, BJ Whitmer, Brian Danielson, Homicide, and Samoa Joe. CZW's team was Chris Hero, Claudio Castagnoli, Cesaro, Eddie Kingston, Nate Webb, and Necro Butcher. And it's like, in that, you have a lot of future world champions and then Necro Butcher. Yeah. So.
Like, you got Necro Butcher in there.
Yeah, who I think just beat Lymphoma and now is not wheelchair bound anymore. So great for Necro Butcher.
Good for Necro Butcher.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw that recently. So
nice. So after this CZW feud that they were in, Brian Danielson began a feud with the Ring of Honor Pure Champion, Nigel McGuinness. This feud would ultimately lead to them unifying the two titles, the Ring of Honor World Championship and the Ring of Honor Pure Championship. Brian Danielson winning both championships and retiring the Pure Championship as its last champion, which was a title that he held basically until 2020 last year in the pandemic when Ring of Honor reinstated the title.
Yeah, but I hate to keep stopping
then,
us.
That's, Oh, no, go ahead.
I was going to say, I hate to keep stopping us, especially because, like, how far into the episode we are and we're not into WWE yet, but...
We're not even to WWE round one.
No, but that's okay. The Pure Championship, again, I don't know if we'll ever talk about this again, was, I think, the coolest thing ever. It was a IC title that had very specific rules, where I believe each wrestler only had a limited number of rope breaks throughout the match, and once they exhausted them, they couldn't get out of submissions anymore.
Yep.
Yeah, and there was no punching allowed in the match as well, I think. So it was like a true throwback to a different era of wrestling. I thought that was really cool, and Daniel Bryanson makes the most sense as the champion for that. Is it fair to say, Tyler, that if you've never seen any American Dragon, Brian Danielson, and Ring of Honor, and you're going to go back and watch one match, it should be Brian Danielson versus Nigel McGuinness?
Yeah, probably. Yeah. Definitely. Unless you want to watch, you got 74 minutes to spare.
But I think that, like when I think of it's funny to think of Daniel Bryan as being like a brutalizer. But that is certainly who Brian Danielson was, and it is most evident in the like concussion inducing matches between the two of them, where most of the maneuvers are headbutts, and there are buckets of blood without there ever being a weapon in those matches. And I think those are really like, it's also like, we don't think about how big of a star Nigel McGuinness was too, and it was because of this feud, I think it's fair to say.
Moving on to more cool Ring of Honor things he did during a match with Colt Cabana on August 26th of that same year. Danielson suffered a real injury when he separated his shoulder, and he would actually continue wrestling until he lost the Ring of Honor World Championship to Homicide at Final Battle, his 39th title defense, ending his 15-month reign, where he would take time off to actually heal that injury afterwards. 39 title defenses, that is bonkers. he returned in summer of 2007, beginning his feud with the Ring of Honor World Champion at the time, Takeshi Morishima. He would continue the feud with Morishima until the end of the year. These two, the Morishima feud that he had, they had multiple matches the first one, I believe, Danielson lost, of course, and I think the second one was like a DQ finish or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So they had gone back and forth a couple times.
I could be wrong, but the DQ finish, I think, might have been in a match where Brian legitimately detached his retina.
Yes.
And I think the officials ended the match because Brian Danielson likes to
finish matches.
He likes to, yeah, yeah. So that's the thing that happened.
Yes.
Takeshi Morishima, known for his palm strikes.
Jesus, yeah.
He's an
interesting
guy.
That was what I was
going
to say. Like, absolutely. If you want to look up Brian Danielson versus Nigel McGuinness, please do. But also check out Danielson versus Morishima in one of the many feuds they have. These two beat the crap out of each other. But he would continue this feud with Morishima until the end of the year, finally defeating him at Final Battle in a match billed as the Fight Without Honor.
Yeah,
which
ding,
both
ding,
men
ding.
Were allowed to use weapons. So this is, we're like sort of wrapping up his Ring of Honor time. Just some cool notable items that I picked up from his time in there. Brian Danielson, he competed in the main event of the debut event for Ring of Honor. He competed at the debut pay-per-view of Ring of Honor, and he wrestled on the third episode of television that Ring of Honor ever had. So when they talk about these things of like Brian Danielson being one of the founding fathers of Ring of Honor, these are your reasons why. He was there for the major mm-hmm. events in this company, and it's the proof is in the pudding, really.
And I think that like another part of that is whereas all of his contemporaries in Ring of Honor, the Samoa Joes, the Paul Londons, the Spankies, the Homicides, mm-hmm. the Lowkeys, the Christopher Daniels, the AJ Styles of the world, all the Nigel McGuinnesses of the world, all went to WWE or TNA to mm-hmm. get exposure in a national audience, and Amazing Red all thrown there too. And Brian Danielson is the one person who didn't for the longest mm-hmm. amount of time, you know,
time, yeah.
He was, and I think that helped him improve the like folklore of his mm-hmm. moniker as best wrestler
Dragon.
In the world of the American Dragon. But it's interesting. I wonder why he never went to TNA. I feel like they would have, mm-hmm. they should have been looking to get him.
Yeah, definitely. Especially in, you know, the height of TNA, the 2006, 2007 time.
Hmm.
Brian Danielson also holds the fourth longest Ring of Honor world title reign ever at 462 days, beaten only by Roosh at 498, Nigel McGuinness at 545, and the number one longest reigning champion, kind of a no-brainer, Samoa Joe at 645 yeah. days.
And I feel like Roosh is only ahead of him because of the pandemic, would be my
probably,
guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
A lot of those days
honestly,
had no defenses.
I forget how long they kept that belt on Roosh. Like, it was a long time. But
yeah, yeah.
Pandemic included. During this time that Brian was doing all these things in Ring of Honor, he was also still wrestling for numerous other indie promotions, a lot of ones in the UK region, places like All-Star Wrestling, Frontier Wrestling Alliance, the FWA, the World Association of Wrestling, as well as a lot of U.S. promotions, Pro Wrestling Guerrilla, PWG, Dragon Gate USA, Chikara, just to name a few. But this was all leading him to, in August of 2009, Brian would re-sign with the WWE. Technically, I guess he is re-signing because he did have
mm-hmm.
that
developmental
contract yeah. way back in the day. He would re-sign with WWE in August 2009. Began wrestling dark matches, and he was eventually sent to FCW for championship wrestling, where he finally, that's where he began using Daniel Bryan as his ring name, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Funny
mm-hmm.
funny little information that he had said later in like interviews and stuff, when he was going to change his name, he was given a list of 10 possible ring names to use in WWE. that list, including such great choice names as, of course, Daniel Bryan, but also Buddy Peacock.
Oh, yeah. I love Buddy Peacock.
And Lloyd Bonner is also a great one.
But I feel like the...
Let's talk about Buddy Peacock.
Yeah, let's talk about it. Apparently, he got really close to picking that.
I think William Regal was like,
maybe you should just be Daniel Bryan.
Would the Yes Movement still have had the same amount of gusto and amount of force behind it if they were in arenas chanting Buddy Peacock?
No, but I think he could have been like Daniel the Peacock Bryan, and I think that has a built-in gimmick. Buddy Peacock feels like, what if Dalton Castle ever gets signed by WWE, that will
is
be
what
his NXT name, yes, would be Buddy
exactly.
Peacock, and it will work perfectly. He could also be Lloyd Bonner as well. I mean the whole joke with that is that there's an accent over the N, right? So yeah, that it's like, yeah, boner. Yeah, that's the joke.
I keep going back to like that title unification promo they did with Cena and Orton, where yeah, the crowd literally won't stop chanting Daniel Bryan, and I'm just trying to picture now if they were like Buddy Peacock.
Yeah.
Buddy. Man,
it would have been great when they eventually got bought by Peacock. So.
That's true. He'd have been the face of the company again.
Yeah.
Daniel Bryan would go on to appear on the inaugural episode of NXT on February 23rd, mm-hmm, 2010, I guess, at this point, losing to then World Heavyweight Champion Chris Jericho. After being attacked by his storyline mentor, The Miz, at the time.
You might be asking why there are storyline mentors in NXT. I think it's worth noting for our newer listeners that, yes, NXT at this point was a wrestling promotion / reality TV game show, where like a bunch of developmental wrestlers were paired with pros, and one of them was going to win a contract. Right.
Yes. This was the original iteration of NXT when it was a weird game show.
Yeah. And I remember watching, because I heard that Bryan Danielson was going to be on this NXT thing. And he was like, you know, everyone else on there was legitimately a pretty new wrestler who had only been through the WWE developmental system. And then you had, you know, the king of the indies,
yeah,
there.
Exactly.
And I remember this match against Chris Jericho. I remember it was like a 10-minute match on TV. I remember, mm-hmm, Bryan Danielson flying through the ropes on a suicide dive that like almost injured Chris Jericho. And it's like people in that arena didn't know who he was before. And then he came out and had a barn burner of a match. And they, yeah, were like, oh, I need to go Google who this guy is.
With, yeah, the World Heavyweight Champion.
Yes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In that first iteration of NXT, so Daniel Bryan actually did not do great, if we want to break it down into the numbers. He went on a 10-match losing streak in, mm-hmm, NXT before finally defeating Santino Marella on the May 10th episode of Raw, but to only be eliminated from NXT the following night from the competition. Yeah.
Yeah, there was a weird thing where you could vote. Like, it was like American Idol. It was like audience vote, yeah, to see who stayed on. And I imagine that WWE had to rig the voting.
I think they flubbed some of those numbers.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that being eliminated is probably the best thing that could have happened to him. And it led to the first great promo of his career. Because, you know, in all this, Bryan Danielson was great in Ring of Honor. But it's good that they didn't have the same sort of like TV presence, because he was not a good wrestler on the mic yet. Mm-hmm. And he had the best promo of his career when he got eliminated, being interviewed by Matt Stryker. And Matt Stryker asked him, what is next for Daniel Bryan? And he goes, I'm going to butcher this, but he goes, well, I don't know what's next for Daniel Bryan. He's not that great. But there's this guy I remember who used to kick people's heads in named Bryan Danielson. And I feel like things are going to go pretty well for him.
I got to ask, do you regret leaving the independent scene where you were a big fish in a small pond to ultimately drown in the sea that is the WWE?
Well, that's funny, because Daniel Bryan never wrestled on the independent scene. I don't know, if you go on YouTube, Daniel Bryan, all you ever see is
Daniel Bryan in the WWE. But there was this guy, man, he was out there. He was kicking people's heads in. People called him the best wrestler in the world, the best technical wrestler in the world. He was a champion in Japan and Mexico and Europe. And do you know what his name was? It was, you might know this guy. What's next for this guy?
For Daniel Bryan, I don't know, man. That might be the end of him. I mean, he's eliminated from NXT. I mean, he can't even beat rookies. What's wrong with this guy? He can take Batista to the limit, but he can't beat rookies.
Daniel Bryan might be done, but Bryan Danielson, God knows what's going to happen to him.
And I think that's he got great. Some heat. Like, he was told, like, hey, don't.
Yeah.
Please don't say that again. But I think that it probably showed some people there who doubted that he could connect with a WWE audience. I think that was actually probably did more for him than the Chris Jericho match did.
Yeah. So this is all about his first stint back in the WWE that unfortunately came to an untimely end on the June 7th episode of Raw. This was the episode where the Nexus had invaded. They invaded the ring after a John Cena match, attacking John Cena and destroying the ringside area. I mean, this was the angle where they took the ring apart. They ripped up the floor mats. They broke tables. They just destroyed it, made it into a wasteland, and attacked people at ringside. During this angle, Brian went a little too far by strangling ring announcer Justin Roberts with his own necktie. And to be fair, like it was all a work thing. He wasn't actually choking the man, but this ultimately resulted in WWE legit shoot firing Daniel Bryan for saying basically like, look, man, that was a little too graphic and we have sponsors and we got to let you go.
Well, I think it's important to note that, that Daniel Bryan was not instructed to do the necktie thing. He like him and Justin Roberts like, oh, and then I'll strangle you with the necktie, it'll be great.
Right.
And that this was a incident that, you know, in the middle of the PG era for WWE, they got a bunch of complaints from the TCA and the parent console. So I think that this was more a very easy scapegoat to fire him. And I kind of get the feeling that Daniel Bryan was never actually like, I know they put out a press release and released him, but as we're gonna see with what you're about to say, like, clearly they fired him and were like, okay, you'll be back on this date.
But for at this point, for all intents and purposes, he was fired from the company, and so this was a stint where Bryan Danielson returned to the indies for a little bit and started working more indie shows. 2 weeks after his departure from WWE, Danielson made his return to the independent circuit on June 26, defeating Eddie Kingston at the Chikara event, We Must Eat Michigan's Brain, in Taylor,
that's
Michigan.
Great. I love that.
That's so great. Even better, I specifically pulled this for traditionally in like some indie shows and mostly in Japanese wrestling, if you've seen before the match or during the introductions, they'll throw streamers into the ring. Kind of feels like a honoring thing for the competitors and stuff.
Yeah.
During this match, rather than throwing streamers, fans threw neckties.
Yeah.
And at Bryan Danielson.
This is another one of those things where, like, I actually feel like getting fired was also the best thing that could happen. Yeah. To him at this time, because it also legitimized his character and added another edge to it, and he was suddenly able to get even more indie cred,
But this, like we had said, this return to the indies was very short-lived. Daniel Bryan would return to WWE at SummerSlam 2010, revealed as the seventh member of Team WWE in the 7-on-7 elimination tag match against the Nexus.
Man, he's so great at being revealed as the secret member.
As the secret
elimination
member, yeah.
Yeah.
During this match, so Team WWE did go on to win this. Bryan was eliminated early in the match, but because he was attacked by Miz, throwing back to Miz being his mentor. And mm-hmm. the specific storyline in that was Miz. He not only was he attacked by Miz, but he actually replaced Miz on Team WWE as well.
I think, if I remember correctly, the rest of Team WWE, which I think included Bret Hart in this match for some reason, they were all like, well, we want an actual wrestler on the team with us, so we're going to take Daniel Bryan instead.
Yeah.
This is the impetus of really of their storied rivalry.
Yes. Yeah. And they did. They had a little, a good little feud in WWE, ultimately culminating in the two of them fighting for the United States Championship at Night of Champions. Daniel Bryan going on to win, tapping out Miz to win his very first title in the WWE, the United States Championship. He would go on then. He would actually return to NXT Season 4. It's honestly, it's wild to me that they made 4 seasons of game show NXT.
Mm-hmm.
He returned to NXT Season 4, this time as a pro, with his rookie, Derek Bateman, or better known as EC3.
I know we are behind, but I need to stop to talk about this for a second.
Absolutely.
If there's one thing that you watch from listening our episode, don't have it be any of the technical wrestling classics that Daniel Bryan has done. Instead, watch the episode of NXT Season 4 where, because it's a dumb game show, they're doing this thing that's like the Newlywed Game where they like ask a question to both the pro and the rookie and see if they can guess what they said is their answer. And clearly, Bryan Danielson and Derek Bateman before this were told what the questions were, and they decided, we're going to cheat. And they decided in order what the like 5 nonsense answers they were going to give were, mm-hmm. and they don't answer the questions at all. But they both seemingly out of nowhere are able to predict, like, yeah, this is what he was going to say, purple monkey dishwasher. And they are so proud of themselves. And it's clear that Matt Stryker or whoever the host was, that like they didn't tell anyone else they were going to do this. And it's amazing seeing how much they celebrate getting these stupid questions right. It's so good. You have to watch it.
That's excellent. So after that, these next ones, like we're going to kind of run through, and it's basically just like hitting like major points in kind of like just the trajectory of where Bryan's career is going at this point before we get to like a real major one that you'll definitely know what that is. So in late 2010, this is after he had won the United States Championship from Miz at Night of Champions. They had begun the storyline with the Bella Twins, where they were seemingly competing for Bryan's affection on screen and everything. I was definitely not watching at the time, so I don't really remember how that ended or what. I think they definitely had like some mixed tag matches mm-hmm. and things with other people, but.
Well, this gets close to him being with AJ Lee, right?
This was prior. Yeah.
Yeah. But this is the beginning. I think this is an important part of Bryan's career, because while he is certainly still being asked to deliver good matches on pay-per-views mm-hmm. and on TV, this is his education in really letting
in
himself be goofy. He's a goofy guy, as we all know now, but mm-hmm. I think because he had to keep up the appearance of the American Dragon for so long, he probably had this in Ring of Honor, we just never got to see it.
Probably.
And and this, like, he really adapted pretty quickly to being a comedic force in WWE.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And a
romantic force,
year,
I guess, too.
Yeah. The following year, March 14th episode of Raw, Bryan would actually lose his United States Championship to Sheamus, ending his 176-day reign. Next, at Money in the Bank 2011, Bryan would win the SmackDown Money in the Bank briefcase, earning him a World Heavyweight Championship match. And I'm sure nothing else of note happened at that pay-per-view.
No, not that I can remember.
After a feud with then World Heavyweight Champion Mark Henry, ultimately failing to capture the title. So Bryan actually gets a title match against Mark Henry without using his contract, like through other means, but ultimately fails to capture it in that first attempt. Brian cashed in his Money in the Bank contract on December 18th at TLC, Tables, Ladders, and Chairs, against Big Show, who had just defeated Henry and subsequently received a DDT on a steel chair, which allowed Brian to secure a pinfall victory for his first World Heavyweight Championship. This also making him the first ever wrestler from NXT to win a WWE World Championship.
I didn't know that. That's interesting. I didn't know that either. It's also like a technicality. Because it's like beyond like technically him being from NXT, at this point, the World Heavyweight Championship is also basically like a glorified
the secondary championship. Yeah.
This was when the draft was over, but like the World Heavyweight Champion basically was the SmackDown champion at a time when SmackDown was just that show that we have on Friday nights. Yeah, it was that is some really dark eras of mm-hmm. television. I think this is why people forget that like YesleMania is not actually his like first world title. Not even close.
It was during this time, of course, that this is when Brian began the romantic storyline with AJ Lee.
Who was the hottest, the most over person on the roster, regardless of gender or like anything. Like AJ Lee was the biggest star at this time.
But so this storyline would go on for several months. She played a role in a lot of his victories in the coming months as well. So after a few successful title defenses as the World Heavyweight Champion, he would go on to face the Royal Rumble winner Sheamus at WrestleMania 28. Now this match is notorious for an obvious reason, but to set it up basically, leading up to this match, they are planting seeds of dissension between Daniel Bryan and AJ Lee, where they're fully like an on-screen couple, but they're starting to have issues and stuff, and they're not working perfectly well together and things like that. So in this match, the
opening match
sequence of events is as follows.
Yeah.
They get into the ring, they're ready to start the match. Bell rings and the two men are about to walk up to face each other, but Brian returns to his corner to receive one last good luck kiss from AJ Lee, and then he turns right into a brogue kick where Sheamus pins him 1-2-3 to defeat him for the World Heavyweight Championship in 18 seconds.
It's notable as a storytelling device. It's notable as being a world title match that's this short as the opener of WrestleMania with the Royal Rumble winner in it too. People did not like this.
This was a
bad way to start a WrestleMania. And I think we could debate, but is this when the Yes Movement starts? Is this like the official, the first shot, the inciting incident that makes people go like, wait a minute,
I think
the best wrestler in the company lost in 18 seconds.
I think if we want to like really break it down, and if like you really examined it, like yes.
Or is this like the Boston Tea Party to the American Revolution?
Almost,
it's
this was the first thing where it got people like, wait a minute, that's not right. Yeah, definitely. It's weird. I feel like I have a memory of watching this live. Or like seeing that moment live, but I definitely was not watching at the time.
And like we were on our way back in, though.
The network wasn't a thing yet, so like I would have had to like order the WrestleMania pay-per-view and all that stuff.
I mean, this was once in a lifetime. This was Rock versus Cena, that WrestleMania. So it was one that conceivably I feel like you could have came. This was around the time that I was coming back into my fandom as well. Yeah.
Okay. It's possible. So after this loss at WrestleMania, this of course is just planting even more of the seeds of dissension between Brian and AJ, ultimately leading to Brian on screen breaking up with her, just leaving her an emotional wreck. Brian was a full heel at this point, and he actually began feuding with CM Punk for the WWE Championship, which sounds incredible.
It was great. I very distinctly remember that, that even though this is like a really silly storyline between them that has a failed wrestling wedding involved, and AJ Lee goes from wearing Brian's shirts to dressing like Punk and sitting in the ring, this crazy romantic storyline also does like end up in matches with them where they do a callback to Ring of Honor and do the handshake at the beginning of their matches. And that is a really fun thing to see in a WWE ring.
Yeah. But so this feud that he had with Punk for the WWE Championship, the subplot going on here is going back to the AJ Lee storyline with Bryan Danielson. So he had broken up with AJ and she was really emotionally wrecked about it. And they had sort of like, he had sort of like worked it out basically to where, on Raw 1000, Brian had proposed to AJ, proposed marriage to her, and she had accepted, and they were going to do the wedding on Raw 1000. Of course, the twist in it ultimately is that AJ, the face almost in the feud between her and Brian,
again, the most popular person in the company at this point,
most popular person in the company, who seems to be being manipulated by the heel Daniel Bryan at this time, leaves Brian at the altar and instead accepts Mr. McMahon's offer to become the full-time Raw general manager. Now, what this means is that now she gets to enact all kind of revenge on Brian by booking him in bad matches that he doesn't want to be in and ruining his chances at the title and things like that.
I think this... does she bring out him saying no instead of yes? Because he had already been saying yes before the yes movement. I think when he becomes a heel here, he starts saying no.
He starts saying
because
no,
he's so distraught at being left at the altar.
That
he's
sounds
like, no.
Right.
And yeah, I know that because of with his stuff with Kane, who is also... This is a really big woven storyline that actually is, in retrospect, is pretty
there's
great.
There's so many moving parts in this one storyline. If you like, when you break it down, that feud that he was having with Punk originally, so Kane had also been inserted to that feud as well, like sort of randomly, but he was present as well. So after this time, when AJ becomes the Raw general manager, she eventually, as punishment for Brian, books him and Kane in arguably one of the funniest storylines that has been on WWE in a very long time. And she books Kane and Brian to undergo anger management with Dr. Shelby. And this leads to so many awesome promos of the two of them backstage in like your traditional, you know, AA style meeting, people sitting in a circle in chairs, and we're gonna go around the room and share with everyone today promos with Kane and Brian, and they were so great.
Yeah,
so funny.
The most strange bedfellows you could ever have, and they are fantastic together.
Yeah. But so these promos, like, they were such a hit with fans. Like, people loved them. They were so funny. This naturally, like you said, strange bedfellows, the odd couple, leads to the formation of Team Hell No of Daniel Bryan and Kane, who would go on to win the tag titles from then champions Kofi Kingston and R-Truth, and had a really long reign with those titles. After winning them, of course, they began a long feud with the debuting Shield, who... You know, Seth Rollins, Roman Reigns, and Dean Ambrose. This was way before they were to the heights that they were. This was when the Shield had just showed up. This was even before the Shield itself was super over. Because, like, yes, like, there was a time when the Shield was the hottest thing going, but when they first debuted, like, I think people were still very like, what the heck is this?
It was confusing, like, in storyline, what they stood for, because for at this point, they were mostly coming in and...
At this point,
the finishes to CM Punk matches.
Yeah,
like that is
yeah.
that is what their purpose was for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they actually like truly ascend to being as popular at WrestleMania 30. I would say when Brian does too, but we're almost there. I'll get out of the way. Let's get there.
Yes, but so they had a really long feud with the Shield, ultimately culminating in them losing the tag titles to Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns at Extreme Rules 2013, ending their tag team reign at 245 days.
Wow. That has to be one of the longest modern tag reigns for like a non-tag team unit, you know. Yeah.
That was what I was going to say. It's like, I knew they were tag champions, but I did not remember it being that long.
The roster was also really thin at this point. Oh, yeah. Because, I mean, the New Age Outlaws would become tag team champions shortly after this. So
that is true. But that segues us into the real next part of Daniel Bryan's career, and this is the Yes Movement. July 15th episode of Raw. John Cena declares his opponent for SummerSlam for the WWE Championship is going to be Daniel Bryan. So this led to Bryan being embroiled in this storyline with the McMahon family's internal feud kind of going. Mm-hmm. And this is
the birth of the authority.
Exactly. Yeah. The birth of the authority and everything. The feud going here is basically the WWE chairman, Vince McMahon, does not like Daniel Bryan because Daniel Bryan does not fit the image of the typical WWE wrestler. He's short. He's not super built. He doesn't have like perfect long wet hair.
He had terrible hair at this point. I think Bryan grew into looking like a mountain man at this starts here, but like his like boyish hair before that was pretty bad.
yeah, absolutely. So that was the feud was built upon this, that Bryan just didn't fit the image of what they wanted to be their top guy. On August 18th at SummerSlam, Daniel Bryan actually defeats John Cena to win his first WWE championship.
Crowd goes wild, huge pop, but people forget it because why, Tyler?
Well, they'll never forget it because special guest referee at the time, Triple H, as he's raising Daniel Bryan's arm into the air, decides instead he's going to hit him with a pedigree. This leads to Randy Orton, the current Money in the Bank winner, to come out and cash in his title to, of course, pin Daniel Bryan, a lifeless Daniel Bryan, to be declared the new WWE champion.
Yeah, his reign lasts all of like 15 seconds.
Yep, so. Basically.
Let's say 18 seconds just to keep it in storyline.
Yeah. There you go. So that right there, if what we were saying, like, the loss to Sheamus was the beginning, this is the second nail in the proverbial coffin of the beginning of the Yes Movement. In the coming weeks, the authority goes on to label Bryan as a B+ player, which, to be fair, is like one of Stephanie McMahon's best promos. It's like, I really dug that one.
I was going to say that, like, I know that like the greatest rivalry in WWE TV ever is Steve Austin and Vince McMahon, but I think people sleep on just how good the rivalry between Bryan and Stephanie McMahon was at this point, maybe because like Triple H is all like so many other people in the authority are involved, but like it's just as good, the exchanges
it's
between
just
them
as good. But she would they labeled Bryan a B+ player, but Bryan would still go on to defeat Randy Orton for the WWE championship at Night of Champions. So he is got the title, lost
twice.
It immediately from Triple H and Randy Orton, goes on to defeat Orton again for the title. So at this point, he's a two-time WWE champion.
Yep.
Only to be stripped of the title the following night by Triple H, claiming that the referee had fast counted.
Mm-hmm. They're playing their hits here, which is it's interesting because the MO that we're going to get into in a second is that even with all these references to McMahon versus Austin and the reference to Chris Jericho fast counting the title away after beating Triple H, that even like even though they're playing the hits, the feeling is that Daniel Bryan still was not who they were actually wanting to feature, which is kind of crazy because it feels so perfect and it becomes so perfect as you're about to say, but it's in spite of themselves.
Exactly. So he would go on then to challenge Orton again, but this time for the vacant WWE championship at Hell in a Cell. However, he would lose this match after being super kicked by another special guest referee, HBK Shawn Michaels.
His trainer?
His own trainer.
He's like, I should have killed you at the start.
HBK.
Yeah. Yeah.
If anything, Brian just needs to, whenever they recommend a special guest referee, just a no, just a hard no. After this, he kind of stepped away from the world title picture for a second and began feuding with the Wyatt family. And on the last Raw of 2013...
People were not having it.
But after the last Raw of 2013, after being beaten down by the Wyatt family, again acknowledged that no matter how many times the fans chanted yes or supported him, it wasn't enough for the machine of WWE. So he gave up and decided to join the Wyatt family. Now, that sounds super defeating and sad and like, oh, I can't believe it happened. Don't worry, it only lasted like 2 weeks. And I think, in my mind, like how we were talking about major points in the yes movement and stuff, I think in my mind, this was where they ended this Wyatt family storyline after like only 2 weeks. I think this was one of the real like first times where WWE was like, we have a story in mind for this, but we have to change it.
Yeah. Like, they certainly wanted Randy Orton versus Dave Bautista.
Yes.
With Bautista coming back from Hollywood being a fan favorite. And they clearly wanted to do Daniel Bryan and Bray Wyatt on WrestleMania or something like that. I mean, you say that this was on the last Raw of 2013 that they officially take Daniel Bryan out of the ongoing storyline and put him somewhere else. It's important to note that segment that we mentioned earlier really like is the first time that the audience hijacks the show to be like, we don't want to see Randy Orton unifying the title with John Cena. We want to see Daniel Bryan, and we're going to chant his name throughout this entire really important segment with all these people. That was before. Because that title unification match was at TLC 2013 in December. They punish the fans, hijack it, and I think Daniel Bryan, the performer, gets punished for it. And is like, we got to put him as far away from this as possible so that the fans will shut up about it. And that doesn't work.
Absolutely. And so my point on that, I remember watching this and how they ended the storyline with the Wyatt family so prematurely. You couldn't help but feel like this wasn't the plan. Like, there's no reason that WWE would put Bryan in this feud with the Wyatts to only last 2 weeks to have him, you know, be defeated and give in to this pull, the dark pull of the Wyatt family, to only have him return to himself in 2 weeks. So that one felt very much like, wow, this is something is happening. Like, things are changing. Like we were saying, this feud only lasted like 2 weeks. Bryan would eventually defect from the Wyatt family. This is after Bray assaulted him after the cage match that Bryan and Bray had against the Usos. They lost that match, and so Bray went on to punish Bryan in the ring. But that would ultimately lead to Bryan shedding his Wyatt family jumpsuit that he was wearing to reveal his previous Daniel Bryan gear. He beats down Bray and the rest of the Wyatt family, scales the cage, and leads an audience in one of the best yes chants ever from the top of the cage with the entire arena following.
I think we got to stop one more time just for a little bit of context of part of the reasoning why WWE changes course here.
Yes.
Is there's a lot of other negative stuff going on in the company. The Royal Rumble happens in between these two things, and Daniel Bryan is not in the Rumble match, and people are really upset about it, and it ruins the return of Rey Mysterio, and it ruins the return of Dave Bautista, and CM Punk, who's been getting more and more disgruntled throughout this final year, quits the day after the Royal Rumble. So you have that powder keg, and you have these two things that were surefire hits in Rey Mysterio and Dave Bautista that suddenly become duds because people are so loud about Daniel Bryan. So that is, I think, those three things happening on the same night, I think, is really what pushes WWE to be like, okay, this is what we have to do.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And so at that point, he has turned on the Wyatt family and returned back to traditional Daniel Bryan that we know. On March 10th, the Occupy Raw happened. If you guys remember, or if you don't, Daniel Bryan and several fans occupy the ring on Raw and refuse to leave.
When you say several, it sounds like there's like seven. There's like a few hundred.
There's like a few hundred. Yeah. Just like completely enveloping the ringside area, the ring itself. And they're like, we're not going to leave until we get what we want. This results in an awesome promo thing from Triple H where he's threatening to charge the ring with this crowd of people in there. And ultimately, he gives in to what Brian's demand for. And Brian is demanding a match at WrestleMania with the one person who has been blocking him this entire way, and that's Triple H.
Yeah.
With the main stipulation being that the winner of their match at WrestleMania would be inserted into the WWE World Heavyweight Championship match, the main event that same night.
Mm-hmm. I don't think Triple H was going to be put into the match if he had won. I think it's just that like he's preventing Daniel Bryan. Yeah.
That makes sense.
This is probably the best segment of WWE TV in this era of wrestling besides the pipe bomb. I think this is like
Occupy Raw.
I mean, it has the most actual like stakes and tension and was the most like unpredictable. So they had not done anything quite like that before and have not since. Yeah. So.
If again, like these are all moments, like this is why part of why the Yes Movement was so unique and captivating for fans at the time, because it's so much of it felt
real,
not only new but exactly real, and like
it broke
like,
conventions of, and like, of storytelling
breaking
too,
conventions
yeah.
You're like I don't know exactly what's gonna happen next, but yeah, so this led to WrestleMania 30. Daniel Bryan would go on to face Triple H early on in the evening, and they had a really good one-on-one match together. Ultimately, he would go on to beat Triple H and be inserted into the main event. The story of that first match with Triple H, of course, is an injury angle. I believe it was his shoulder that Triple H had been working on and stuff throughout the match. So even though he wins, Bryan is not at 100% going into his main event match. Of course, your perfect babyface storyline leading into this title match. Main event of the evening, this triple threat match, Batista, Randy Orton, and Daniel Bryan for the WWE World Heavyweight Championship match. We watched this live, you and I.
Friend of the pod, Brad Strong.
Yes, yeah. Friend of the pod, Brad Strong, at his place in Blacksburg. I remember this match. And it was unfortunate because like this was a great match, but it was also... This was the same night that the Undertaker's streak was broken.
Yeah, and so it sucked the air out of the
I was going to say, I remember after that match happened, the rest of the event kind of blurs for me.
Yeah.
Like, I know we watched this, and I know we were super excited when Daniel Bryan won, but it just is like, did that happen?
Yeah. But I mean, this still is like, this is the stuff of WrestleMania moments and video packages, and a great call by Michael Cole with Miracle on Bourbon Street.
Yep.
And then I think Jerry Lawler says WrestleMania 8 times after that. But like, this is a great picture perfect moment. And I think it's why people wrongly remember this as being like, oh yeah, the first time he won the title, but it's
exactly,
like the first time he won it for real.
Exactly. Yeah. But unfortunately, this feel good end, the culmination of the Yes Movement storyline, it was excellent. It was perfect. One of the best paid off wrestling storylines that WWE has ever done. Unfortunately, it did come to a premature end due to a legit injury. Bryan did have to drop the title. only 64 days into his reign, and storyline, mm-hmm. they ultimately stripped him of the title, ending his reign on July 9th.
I will say in that point, he did get to have one flaming tables match with Kane. I'll put it out there. So that exists.
Yes. Yes. And so at that point, after he had dropped the titles for injury and stuff, he would leave, and he would come back ultimately to wrestle here and there. A notable thing, he was eliminated from the Royal Rumble in 2015, with the again, akin to the crowd turning on the rest of the show, like this mm-hmm. previous Royal Rumble, in Philadelphia, the crowd, would go on to boo the rest of the show.
This is
including
the
eventual winner, Roman Reigns.
This is The Rock holding up Roman Reigns' hand and being confused as to all the boos, right?
To a chorus of this. Boos.
Yeah.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, Brian entered at number like 3 or 4. He mm-hmm. entered very early, and he was one of the 3 or 4 people that they had been focusing on in storyline as potential mm-hmm. winners. And I think he was eliminated before like number 15 or 14 came out. So it did feel early.
It was early enough that he was eliminated that it got awkward.
Yeah,
for the rest of the show that they were still booing.
Yeah. I get the idea that like if they wanted to prevent a major Roman boo fest, they're like, we got to get Brian out of there so that there's time.
Hopefully they.
But that.
Yeah.
But that was not how it worked.
It did not work. Moving that later, WrestleMania 31 going on. Brian would actually win the Intercontinental Championship at that in a 6-man ladder match. It was a great match, actually. Mm-hmm. I do remember that one.
Outdoor and, Levi Stadium. Yeah. Super bright. Yeah.
I remember him winning that match, and it was great. Again, unfortunately, this would lead to another premature title reign as well. Daniel Bryan will ultimately have to drop the title on May 11th. Relinquishing it to an injury-esque angle, basically what he had disclosed to fans and stuff, that he had undergone an MRI, and some things came up that were alarming, mm-hmm. and in interest of his health and going forward and stuff, he relinquished the title.
Yeah, but we as fans did not know at this point is that there have been multiple times at events where he had seizures.
Yes.
Backstage.
Yeah, we were not aware of
his extremities.
Severity of it, exactly. Mm-hmm. And at this point, Bryan Danielson is off wrestling television for a long time.
Nearly a year.
Nearly a year until February 8th, 2016, when Daniel Bryan retires officially on Raw in his home state of Washington.
Yeah. Shocking.
Shocking.
Kind of, I don't know where we knew he was dealing with a weird injury, mm-hmm. but didn't know the extent of how bad it was.
Yep. It was rough. The real sad segment up there with like Edge's retirement and things like that. So it was a tough one.
is the tragedy we referred to, and I think we've learned recently that part of why the decision was made to outright force him to retire mm-hmm. was the fact that Brian had lied to WWE doctors about his seizures and about some of these injuries. And I think it was the kind of thing that if he got paralyzed in a match because of concussions, or then it would really negatively affect the WWE's liability.
Yes.
Since
absolutely.
He had disclosed this. So I think Daniel said that recently, like, yeah, I get that they had to force me to retire because like I screwed this up. Mm-hmm. But it all seems like it was a thing that was avoidable. I think that's the worst part about it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So in February, Daniel Bryan retires and we don't see him for a while. He takes some time off until July 18th of that same year. Brian's actually brought back as an on-screen character, not to be an active wrestler, but as the new SmackDown general manager. Going on in this time, Brian is doing your traditional general manager role and stuff. I think this was around the time, wasn't this around the time where they did the story where they wanted to make SmackDown like the land of opportunity and all
yeah.
that?
Yeah, him and Shane yes. McMahon are kind of like Brian is the general manager, but Shane is like the owner of SmackDown, and they are like a cohabitating like buddy group. Mm-hmm. This is also like, I mean, you're about to go into it. I see now that like this is where Brian really gets to refine his chops as a promo master.
Yes.
He pushes ahead a lot of great storylines with the likes of Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn around this mm-hmm. time. Mm-hmm. And he is the patron saint of talking smack, which is an unexpected hit.
An unexpected short-lived hit of Daniel Bryan and Renee Young hosting a post-SmackDown interview show that was like,
like Talking Dead, yeah.
Well, yeah. That's also like the main appeal is like it's like half kayfabe, half shoot sort of, where everything basically seems to be kayfabe except Daniel Bryan, who is 100% shooting on everything.
He shoots on The Miz, and it's the best thing that happened to The Miz. And
exactly,
years
this, too. Yeah. This led to one of the best Miz promos ever, and probably the best thing that happened to The Miz in years was the heated altercation they had on Talking Smack, where Miz just goes off on Daniel Bryan and storms
yeah.
out. It was excellent.
He goes off on him because Daniel says, you know, people don't like you because you are too...
You're soft.
You're too soft. And yeah. because they are polar opposites who were contemporaries, the Miz is like, you say soft, but I think I'm safe. Like, there's a reason yeah. that I'm sitting over here and I'm the WWE Intercontinental Champion. He's a champion at the point. There's a reason yes, that I'm yes. here still wrestling and you are forced to retire.
Yeah.
And it gets really real very quickly. And it continues making the idea of The Miz versus Daniel Bryan the dream match that we didn't know we even wanted to be a dream match. But
yeah.
they are such perfect polar opposites that it mm-hmm. works out. Yeah.
Yeah. But so again, during this time, so Bryan is just doing his SmackDown general manager role and things like that. But this ultimately leads to a very, I'm going to say surprise.
Yeah.
There obviously is talk this whole time while Bryan is not wrestling of Bryan trying to get back into the ring, going to see doctor after doctor after doctor, trying to get cleared for in-ring competition. And
I think I'm recorded on this show as saying that I hoped that he would never get cleared again.
Yes.
Because I didn't want him to die. Yeah.
That's fair. That's totally fair. And it very much was like a surprise when it was announced March 20th, 2018, after nearly 2 years of medical evaluations and reviews, Daniel Bryan was cleared to wrestle in WWE again. Now, I remember this because it was, I thought that the protocol of how they did it seemed real backwards to me. But I guess when you think in terms of like TV ratings and all that stuff, like it's probably for the best. They announced it.
Yeah.
Via
they
Twitter.
Wanted people to watch. Yeah.
They announced it via Twitter earlier in the day and they had just posted. They said, breaking news, Bryan Danielson is cleared to wrestle. So of course everyone is tuning into SmackDown that night to see what the heck is going on. And this leads to an amazing promo where Bryan comes back and says, I'm cleared. I'm going to wrestle again. To be fair, I remember watching this live and it was so crazy because prior to this, of course, Bryan is tangentially involved in this feud with Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, and Shane McMahon. That same night that he is finally cleared to wrestle, at the end of the night, Kevin Owens and Sami Zayn beat the crap out of
yeah.
Daniel Bryan.
Yes, they really do.
They really do. They
rip off that
Band-Aid
real fast.
Real
fans.
Fast,
yeah.
Like immediately. So fast that like I think definitely myself and probably a lot of viewers were like, hold on. What, is he okay?
Like, yeah, can they do that to him? Yeah.
But yeah, this led to... Bryan's return, his first return match would be at WrestleMania 34, that following in a tag match with Shane McMahon. A lot of people were upset that Daniel Bryan's return match was a tag team match with Shane McMahon,
it
myself
was
included.
It was fine. It was a good
it
match.
It was totally fine. And again, in in terms of caring about the man's health, I'm glad that it was a tag match with these guys. Totally okay.
Although, speaking of caring about their health, how quickly we forget that during this match, like 2 days before, Shane McMahon got diverticulitis and then yes, had to like wrestle a majority of the match since Daniel was the hot tag. Poor Shane. Gutted that one out.
Yeah. So at this point, Daniel Bryan has returned to live, you know, wrestling and everything. He's back. And WWE did one of my favorite things that they had done recently with Daniel Bryan was on November 13th, SmackDown Live, Daniel Bryan would defeat AJ Styles for the WWE Championship, but only by turning heel, hitting him with a low blow, and being a heel for the first time in WWE since 2012. This led to the new Daniel Bryan, one of my favorite iterations of the Daniel Bryan character. His new heel persona, where Bryan would channel his very real values of environmentalism and use them against the crowd, calling people wasteful. And my favorite is fickle.
Yeah.
Fickle. Such a good insult. And this led to such great things. Like he revamped the WWE Championship to make it a belt made from sustainable materials.
The big hemp belt.
The
I
hemp
loved
belt with hemp the wooden wood. Plates and
it's
the gemstones on it. Oh,
it's so good looking.
It's so great.
He utilizes Eric Rowan really well as his henchman during this time. Oh, going back to their brief Wyatt family ties. Yeah.
Loved it. This was one of my favorite iterations of Daniel Bryan. So good. And of course, this led to the culmination of another one of the best storylines that WWE has put on in recent years, was the culmination of Kofi Mania in WrestleMania 35.
Mm-hmm.
Kofi Kingston challenging Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship at WrestleMania. Excellent lead up, excellent story, excellent payoff. Love
it. Yeah, it was fun to be able to see that this storyline of Kofi Mania is not very different from the storyline leading up to WrestleMania, and that Kofi is again like a longtime popular fan favorite who is told by an authority, not the authority, but told by Vince McMahon that he's never going to be the champion. And you get to see Daniel Bryan, formerly the B-plus player, now get to play Triple H basically in this part. And it was a fun stunt casting, I guess you would say. Yeah, but it worked out great.
So good. After the culmination of Kofi Mania, at this point, you know, Daniel Bryan, he went on to have some notable feuds with people, guys like Roman Reigns, The Fiend, Drew Gulak.
Yeah.
He had the feud with Gulak was excellent. I wanted to say, it wasn't really a feud, but he did have an incredible match with Brock Lesnar for the Universal Championship, I believe it was. At some pay-per-view or something. Like
Survivor Series or Clash of Champions or one of those.
Survivor Series sounds good. There wasn't a huge lead-up to this match, but it was an excellent match because Brock actually came to work that day.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, this period after the new Daniel Bryan is not like a lull, but it is a lot of Daniel working with people like Drew Gulak and Chad Gable and other people that maybe are underutilized and just having really stout matches with them. He doesn't have a whole lot of direction, but it didn't feel like he was being misused.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
He went on to compete in the WrestleMania 37 main event. This is against Roman Reigns.
That was this year, wasn't it? That was this year, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Seems so long ago.
This year, the WrestleMania 37 main event against Roman and Edge for the Universal Championship. He would ultimately go on to lose that match, being pinned by Roman at the same time he was pinning Edge. this led to continuing a feud with Roman, basically, where they set up the championship versus career match on April 30th, 2021, where Daniel Bryan got one last shot at the Universal Championship, and if he didn't win, he would leave WWE. Now, this we've talked about before on the show, a classic loser leaves town match. Well, in this case, one loser would leave town match.
Yeah.
Which is always a classic throwback kayfabe stipulation in wrestling. But this one actually had a little twist on it.
In that it was real?
kind of wasn't kayfabe.
No, it wasn't.
Behind the scenes, Daniel Bryan's very real contract was expiring on, I believe, April 30th or like the day after, on May 1st, something like that. So when he ultimately did lose this match, he was gone from WWE, actually. He was no longer an employee of that company.
Yeah. I think if this is the last WWE match that Daniel Bryan has, I'm happy that it was against Roman Reigns, because maybe an unpopular opinion, but I think that Roman was his best rivalry in WWE. They had amazing matches together. Like, all apologies to The Miz, which was the best prolonged rivalry he had, and all apologies to Randy Orton and Triple H and people in the Authority. Mm-hmm. But like, Roman and Daniel without any storyline attached is a fantastic pairing in the ring as a styles clash. It just works for whatever reason. Those two guys really get each other. So I'm happy that that was his last match in WWE.
I agree. And so potentially that is, I mean, to so far, that is his last match in WWE. Of course, leading up until September 5th of this year, very recently, actually, Bryan Danielson made his surprise debut for All Elite Wrestling at All Out.
Yeah.
And what a moment that was.
It was. And since then, he's only been having amazing matches against opponents he didn't think he was going to be able to wrestle. He just had a barn burner against Suzuki on TV last week. And
I think, 2 weeks ago. And then he had the match with Bobby Fish last week. Had the match with Omega,
it seems like he is having fun and fulfilling ticking some boxes before he will eventually be done. I know that we're running up on 2 hours, so I'm just going to throw out two questions about the future of Daniel Bryan. One, how close do you think he was to re-signing with WWE? What would have had to happen? I know that they were having negotiations with New Japan to try to placate Bryan, but do you think that the fact that AEW had already had those conversations and like lined things up with New Japan, do you think that's what it was? Like that was the number one biggest issue?
I don't know if it's the biggest issue, but I bet that played a very big role. Bryan had said, you know, like he didn't want to be necessarily a full-time guy. He wanted to have the schedule that he wanted, a smaller schedule with more freedom in terms of being able to spend time with his family, but also freedom in terms of being able to wrestle elsewhere. And I think that of all the people WWE has employed for them, Bryan was one of the few that they probably actually considered. They were like, we wouldn't allow most people to do this, but if Daniel Bryan wants to wrestle in Japan, maybe we let him. Maybe we do. So I think it was a major thing for him. I think, and WWE probably really considered it. I bet they did. But the AEW the deal was probably just a little sweeter, and I think that plays into a lot of things about AEW that appeal to a wrestler like Daniel Bryan. More freedom in the way that they get to wrestle, the way they get to present their character and things like that.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. The other big question, this is the big question, now that the tragedy is over for the time being, what does Bryan Danielson have left to do? How much longer do you think he goes?
Oh boy. I mean, shoot, after watching the Omega match and that Suzuki match, like, I don't think he's ever going to stop. That man's a robot. Like, good God. But I don't know. I mean, I would love, there are things that I would like to see Daniel Bryan do. I would love to see Daniel Bryan in the G1 next year.
Yeah, that's huge for me.
I would love
that needs
to see
happen.
Daniel Bryan make a return to Ring of Honor briefly if they could somehow work that out. There's a lot of things that I would like to see him do. I'm not sure what's in his mind in terms of things he still has yet to accomplish, but
those are the two biggest ones for me. And I know he's signed to AEW and his biggest moments are going to happen there, but I think there would be some justice if his final match was in a Ring of Honor ring.
Yeah.
I don't know who he has it against to make it feel big enough, but I think that would be really nice.
Yeah, that would be nice. Unfortunately, Ring of Honor is the only company that seems to just not be working with anyone right now. So
yeah, but if they, you know, if AEW is like,
hey, do you want Brian Danielson?
Do you want Brian Danielson and CM Punk to come do a show there?
Right.
And we'll use Danhausen for a little bit. I think that's like the trade-off. Like, I think they would be happy to bring their founding people back. So
yeah, absolutely.
Wow.
And that is a wrap for now on Brian Daniels.
79 minutes. We got your 120 minutes right here. This was great. This was amazing. Excellent. I'm happy to be back. Recording and talking about wrestling with you, my friend.
Yes, excellent.
That is more than all the time that we have for today, though. Do you have anything to plug, Tyler, before we get out of here?
I got nothing, guys.
Yeah, I have something to plug, but I'm gonna wait till next episode to talk about it.
That's fair.
Yeah. As a reminder, if you want us to answer your questions in the Kayfabe 520, submit them to us on our website, muchadowrestling.com, on Twitter at adowrestling, or you can email them to us at muchadowrestling@gmail.com. As always, we're going to leave you with the fickle words of the immortal William Shakespeare. If wrestling be the food of love, fight on.
Yes!
I'm going to play, I got to play Final Countdown. Buddy Peacock. Oh, man.